Good evening. My name is Susan Morgenthau, and along with Missy Rennie Taylor and Robin McNeil, I am a co-chair of the Council of Conservators here at the New York Public Library. I'd like to thank you on behalf of the entire council for being here, and I'm very happy to welcome you tonight to what I'm sure is going to be a special program. Tonight begins the fall season for the Conservators. As many of you in the room know, the Conservators program is a membership group, and we raise funds to support general operating expenses for the library. With each passing day, literally, these membership dollars are becoming more and more crucial to our library. It helps it to carry on essential activities such as purchasing books, preserving collections, cataloging and circulating our books and other materials, digitalizing our materials, attracting a very knowledgeable and highly trained staff, all while remaining absolutely free to anyone who walks in the front door. In appreciation for your generosity as we raise these funds for the library, the Council of Conservators, along with our staff, designs and produces a full year of programming for you to enjoy. So if you're a guest tonight, I welcome you and I encourage you to join. If you are already a member, I really cannot thank you enough for your support. I'd like to take a moment to introduce you first to our moderator tonight, Bob Colicello. Bob is a well-known name to many people in the room. He was an editor of Interview Magazine from 1971 to 1983. Since that time, he's been a special correspondent at Vanity Fair, and he has managed to write several books, including Holy Terror, Andy Warhol Close-Up, Ronnie and Nancy, Their Path to the White House, and is currently writing another book about the Reagan, scheduled to be released in 2011. Bob, welcome, and thank you. Because of tonight's schedule, we're going to expedite our introductions for our esteemed panel. Please do not think the length of these introductions has anything to do with their long and talented histories. Susan Cheever is the author of 5 novels. In addition, her most recent publication, Desire, Where Sex Meets Addiction, was released today and is on sale here this evening. That was the cue. Francine Duplessis-Gray, the author of Them, A Memoir of Parents. She is a regular contributor to The New Yorker and the author of numerous books of fiction and nonfiction. She, too, has a recent publication, Madame de Stael, The First Modern Woman, and I'm going to show it to you because we do not have it here tonight, but it was released yesterday. And finally, Honor Moore, the author of The Bishop's Daughter. She is also the author of 3 very fine poetry collections. She is currently teaching at the New School as well as at Columbia University. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
I'd like to start with talking a little bit about the kind of history of writing about one's family.
Writers have always written autobiographies.
They've always written about their families, but it seems to me there's been in recent years a tendency to write much more revealing books, much more intimate books. Certainly, all 3 of you, the books you've written about your families, Them, The Bishop's Daughter, and the book I'm thinking of specifically in your case, Susan, is Home Before Dark, about your father, John Cheever, were much more, I mean, if you think of something like Eugene O'Neill, Long Day's Journey into Night, which was a fictional work, but it was very much about his parents and about his mother's alcoholism, his brother's alcoholism. On his death, he instructed his wife not to open this play for 25 years. She didn't follow his instructions. It was produced 3 years later in 1956, I think it was. And if you go all the way to Catherine Harrison, The Kiss, writing about having an incestuous relationship with her father in 1997, I think it is, we've come a long way. And all 3 of you have written books which are very revealing, to say the least, about aspects of your parents' lives that they may not have wanted revealed. Both of you, Susan and Honor, have written books about your father's secret homosexual lives. Were there precedents? Did each of you have examples? I mean, A Portrait of a Marriage by Harold Nicholson is something that comes to mind, but I'm just wondering, maybe we'll start with you, Francine. You were telling me St. Augustine was the first his father.
I've taught St. Augustine a lot, and what strikes me is that even there was, number one, an instinct for self-dramatization, which there is often in family memoirs, that you have to do something to aggrandize, to exaggerate, in order to create the kind of dramatic tension between the narrator and the person, the family that he's writing about. And there's an early scene in the Confessions in which he's sitting in the public bath with his father. And obviously he is having one of his first erections. He's like 14, 15. The father notices and says, now you are a man. Now we can be men together. And it's the most revealing moments that early in this, even this very first confessional, the man is not afraid of talking about that. He's not afraid of talking about what he refers to as his really intolerable and sinful lust for women. And we find out when we study St. Augustine that he actually was not that unusually lusty a man. He was just the average l'homme moyen sensuel, you know, who just lusted, but not excessively so. But he did use a technique of exaggeration to dramatize himself, and I think it's interesting that it does. But if we come to our time, I think an instant almost more shocking than Catherine Harris and the Kiss is a novel by John Updike. No, not a novel, a nonfiction book called Self-Consciousness, this is what I would call autopathography, in the sense that pathography was a term coined by Joyce Carol Oates to denote the kind of biographical writing or life writing which aggrandizes the unpleasant aspects of such people's characters. And we've come to an era also of autopathography where Updike confesses to being in a car and bringing a woman to orgasm in the back of the car while his wife is driving the car in front. And he takes certain kind of pride in that. The wife is not conscious of anything at all. I find that as revealing and maybe more extreme as some of the other examples, as anything in Catherine's. Well, I think the Harrison thing goes further. I think incest with dad in our time is pretty difficult to handle.
But were there books you used as models before you started your book, Honor? I mean,
I was interested. I really come out of the women's movement. I'm of the generation of the women's movement of the 70s, and my project was always to tell the truth about these sort of patriarchal units that we live in, the first book I read that struck me with its power was Simone de Beauvoir's book, A Very Easy Death, about the death of her mother. And it was terribly striking to me that this great intellectual and philosopher wrote so candidly about the final illness and death of her mother and her relationship with her mother. And you mentioned Portrait of a Marriage. It just reminds me of a story. I met Nigel Nicholson when I was writing my book, The White Blackbird, about my grandmother, Margaret Sargent. And he said, have you discovered any... what was the word he used? Have you discovered any... I'm not remembering the right word, but have you discovered any sort of interesting secrets? Mm-hmm. He used a better word than that. And I said, nothing on the order of yours. But of course, 15 years later, my family was, such a secret was revealed in my family. And so I looked back on that book as a kind of pioneering work in trying to make sense of an unusual kind of marriage, complicated kind of marriage.
And Susan?
My examples are far less exalted.
Mommy dearest?
When my father died in 1982, uh-huh. Home Before Dark came out in 1984,
right.
And when I was writing that book, there was nothing I had no models. I mean, there was J.R. Ackerley, there was Haywire. I mean, there were, you know, The Duke of Deception wasn't out yet. Nobody had written a book about their famous parent, and indeed I thought it couldn't be done. It was one of my problems. And then I actually didn't know my father was gay when I started writing the book. He was dead. And found out that he was gay in the course of writing the book, stopped writing the book, decided I would not be the person to reveal this secret, and then was approached by two gentlemen who both told me that they were going to write biographies of my father in which they were going to reveal this sensational material. My mic just went out, Dad. And so then I went back to the book, saying to myself, you know, writing it prophylactically, saying it to myself, I will represent this in a loving way, which I did. It's very small. Yes. It's one page in the book, so that these other gentlemen, Scott Donaldson and Fred Exley, may he rest in peace, would not be able to make hay with this. So really, I ended up, I always have a mission, and that was my mission, was to represent this in the sweetest possible way.
Yeah, I wonder, because there's a line in the beginning where you, in your prologue where you say, when I started writing this book, if I knew where it was going to
end,
I wouldn't have done it. And that brings me to my next question. Go ahead, for
I forgot to say that if I have a model, I didn't answer that part of your question.
Yes.
It would be Nabokov's Speak Memory.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's one that resounds the most to me as a memoir or as a reflection on family.
Did you feel, each of you, compelled to write these books to, for some personal reason, to deal with your parents and how they've affected you? I mean, was it something you had to do, or?
I think it's kind of the greatest free therapy there is. I mean, you have to untangle and disentangle all the skeins of their lives and the skeins that bound you to them, and it's a very purifying process. It's arduous. It's at times a lot of fun, but it's I wouldn't stress the therapeutic part of it too much because there is so much difficulty in it, so it's not all pleasure. But you feel more whole. Mm-hmm. I report a sense of wholeness.
Mm, absolutely.
A sense
No.
I'm
not agreeing with this.
I had clarified. It's a process of clarification, of clarifying the space around me, clarifying my ties to my ancestors, to my which in turn sort of like, you know, clarifying my ties to the world, and that is a very and it enhances your sense of wholeness and
that's exactly the way I feel. So much emotion. And to untangle all the emotion into a story, to be able to do that, which I felt only able to do because my father and I ended our time on Earth together in a very loving, positive way, so I felt free to explore.
But did you feel you had to write the book?
I absolutely felt I had to. It was this. It was a life or death thing as a writer. I mean, I'm not sure I would have been able to write with, you know, it was this huge thing in front of me and I had to get through it, or it was going to have me. So, yes, I did feel absolutely compelled to do it.
And Susan?
There are two things here that we're talking about. One is being compelled to write the book, which I'm compelled to write every book. Otherwise, writing a book is actually pretty hard. Mm-hmm. The other is this question of therapy. And people would say to me, after I wrote Home Before Dark, or now that I finished Desire, they would say, oh, was that cathartic for you? Mm-hmm. And I need to remind them that catharsis is for the reader, not for the writer. Catharsis happens to the audience, not to the actors. You know, these books are not cathartic for me. If anything, I felt worse after I wrote Home Before Dark.
Because of the criticism, which brings me to one of my other...
Not because of the criticism, although that's certainly no fun, but because in shaping a story so that you will be moved by it, I somehow have to do violence to my own understanding of it. In other words, as a writer, I'm so intent on the reader that it's really not about my feelings and my clarifications. It's about what I can draw out of you, Mr. Reader, Mrs. Reader. And so in the end, I don't feel that it works as therapy for me. Mm-hmm. I wish it did. And it certainly, I certainly don't find catharsis in it, but I'm very compelled. That's a different, mm-hmm. you know, I think we're, I don't think anyone would write a book if they weren't really compelled to.
I just wanted to say one mm-hmm. more thing. I've noticed lately, having finished the book a year and a half or so ago, that now my parents are just people. They're not these kind of talismanic, mm-hmm. you know, emotionally charged figures. And I'm able to miss them as simply as people. That was interesting to me.
How did you react to criticism, or did you get much criticism from family members, from close friends? I mean, Francine, I know, because I'm involved with Condé Nast myself, I know there were people who said, how could Francine write that her mother didn't tell her about her father's death until a year later, and then had friends do it, or how could she write?
What right do they have to make that judgment? I mean, here, I mean, the news of my father's death was broken to me by a near stranger a year after he died, because she hid the fact because she was too much of a coward to tell me. Now, is not an obvious thing that she would write about a parent? I think there were other things. There were other things that I heard about. How could she write that her mother was a drug addict, that she was a Demerol addict for her last 10 years? Well, half of New York knew that anyway. She seems zonked and acts zonked, poor woman. But I miss them. I'm interested in what Anna said. I really miss them more now, having written about them. And I'm able to miss them more deeply.
Yeah.
And I'm able to give tribute to them as well as having given the criticism. You know, there was not much to reveal about Alex, except that whenever I talked to anybody who had been at Condé Nast, they told me how nasty he was and devious.
Devious.
And so that Machiavellian and all those terms came. And he was a sweet Alex who was always been angelic to my mother and me. And to have this rather public monster being thrown at me was rather upsetting. But that's, you know, it's not as bad as, nothing is as difficult as what Catherine Harrison had to deal with, which is sex with dad.
Well, as I said to Francine before we got started, my only criticism of your book was there wasn't enough Diana Vreeland. But in honor, I mean, what's been the reaction to your book among people the Episcopalian Church or family members?
There's been a spectrum of response. There are people who are so grateful for the book, both in family and in the Episcopal Church, and people who totally disapprove. But I've mostly had a very positive response. It's interesting, in contrast to what Francine discovered about Alex, when I went out into the world of my father's work, I was amazed at what I discovered that was so positive about him. So he actually emerged in the process of writing it as a greater man than I had any idea of, which made the whole story much more painful and contradictory.
And Susan, what kind of reactions have you had to
criticism? We're talking about a lot of books here, or the new book, or the...
Well, especially, I mean, the theme of this is really writing about your parents, so...
Well, so after I wrote about my father, then I wrote about my mother, then I wrote about my children, you can see where the less famous the subject is,
But your mother gave you permission, in a sense, to write about your father. She gave you the journals and let you quote from his journals.
Yes.
And so then was she still alive? I'm sorry, when
she's still alive as we speak.
She still is alive, but... So, and she was okay with you writing about her?
She was okay with me writing about her. She was more okay when I wrote a book about her than with the portrait of her. That was why I wrote a book about her. In other words, having written a book about my father, it seemed really unfair to me mm-hmm. Not to tell her side of the story. And there were certainly two sides of the story. But I don't know. I think, you know, I've realized that I write memoir in order to hide. That actually my impulse is the opposite of how it looks. I write memoir to control the story. And that way, the real story, which I assure you is not in any of my memoirs, is hidden in a much more effective way than if I didn't write memoir. I mean, I realize that when I'm written about, because, and I mean, Janet Malcolm's written about this very brilliantly, when I'm written about, it's incredibly disconcerting for me. And I realize it's because I'm used to controlling the story. So I don't know. You know, there's always criticism. There's always praise. When one writes about one's family, some members of the family are furious because you've taken their story. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. Who owns the story is really the question that this panel brings up. And mm-hmm. if you tell a story that's a family story, members of the family will feel they've been robbed. Other members of the family who knew they couldn't tell the story will thank you. I think it always splits. I don't think it's ever one way or the other.
Well, I think in all... go ahead.
It just brings up something very interesting, the Wolfe brothers. Jeffrey Wolfe's Duke of Deception and Tobias Wolfe's This Boy's Life are about the same father, two different mothers, and they're two very different books, very different takes on the same family. And John Darton... told me that when he, Joseph Lelivel told me that when he wrote his was about to publish his memoir, he sent copies of those two books to his siblings and said, "You write your own book."
In all three books, specifically your book about your father, there seems to be that you seem to have the sense that your parents were giving you permission to do this. If in your case, Francine, the discovery of the amount of records they kept. I mean,
well,
the amount of material they kept.
My mother had always said, "You will write about me sometime, won't you?" She did. I said, "Yes, Mom, I will."
So, well, it is very flattering in one sense to devote that much
really,
time and
effort. She really wanted to be written about because she had been very heroic. And I think that most of the book is about her heroic side. I mean, getting us out of occupied France and standing up to the German commandants, you know, and the way that she breathed me out of Paris and all that. But there's something I want to bring up about our attitude towards the writing or towards the biography or the parent, whatever that we. I think there's a strange combination of ruthlessness and compassion that mm-hmm. we have to have. I think we have to be ruthless in being able to talk about dad is gay, mom is a dope addict, whatever. And at the same time, handle it with a kind of compassion, empathy. We've got to have empathy. Because otherwise it becomes pathography, as George right. would say, and I think that balance of compassion and ruthlessness is maybe the single most difficult thing to achieve in these kind of books.
Well, someone said to me, you have to understand your parents' lives in their own terms. You have to understand your father's life in his own terms, and that's similar.
That's right.
So that then he can become a character. Who's autonomous of my judgment or whatever.
You have to be a brute and a thug, but you can't be a liar.
Yeah, I mean, the book I wrote about the Reagans, and it is more difficult, as you point out, to write about people who are alive. You've done that. I sent Mrs. Reagan the galleys and didn't hear from her for 6 weeks. And, you know, and finally someone else interceded, and they said, "Well, Nancy, you know, this is, what did you think of the book?" And she said, "Well, it's a good book, but there were so many unflattering things about me in there." And this person said, "Well, you know, we've all had unflattering things in our lives, but Bob didn't take any cheap shots." And I think that's what you're saying. I think that in writing about people, you have to write about certain controversies, certain scandals, certain warts. I mean, but there's a way to do it and there's a way not to do it, I think. You know, there's the different, you know, so many books that are written, there's the Mommy Dearest being the silliest example, but I mean, there are books that are written out of vengeance, I think.
And rage,
And I think that's, there's some, maybe a little bit of that in all of your books, but you've controlled it, or you've how have you fought that tendency to kind of get even, maybe?
I'm gonna disagree with everyone again. I actually think the important thing is not the attitude of the writer, but the accomplishment of bringing the person to life on the page. Mm-hmm. And I think however you do that, is the right way to do that. And I think sometimes it's vengeance. I mean, you know, The Count of Monte Cristo is a vengeance novel. I mean, vengeance is not such a bad motive. You know, sometimes it's ruthlessness, sometimes it's empathy. But the question is that person alive in the book? Mm-hmm. You know, have you done that incredible, magical thing of bringing that person alive in the book? And I don't really think it matters how you do it or how you feel when you're doing it. I actually think that writing is artifice, that it really, you know, if vengeance is what allows you to do that, great. Mm-hmm. If compassion is what allows you to do that, great.
But are you ready to lie to make it dramatic?
That's a good point.
Well, since my focus is so much on the reader, if I'm going to lie to the reader, I'm going to tell them I'm lying to them. In other words, I'm not...
As long as you do that.
You know, I mean, that's my focus. But I wanted to bring, since we're going to talk about Home Before Dark, I wanted to bring my father to life for the people who read that book.
I think you do. I think in all three books
and,
to your parents.
And that I wrote it very quickly, right after he died, in a complete... Not feeling compassionate or ruthless or vengeful, but terrified that these men were somehow going to beat me to it and sensationalize his life. Mox nix, you know, it came out really well. And I think that's in the hands of whoever controls these things.
When you talk about lying, I mean, there's also a question of interpretation or memory. I mean, your memories are different than your brother's or sister's mm-hmm. memories. I mean...
I'm an only child. Much easier.
Well,
much
you know,
easier.
It's interesting. My sister, who's 10 years younger, read the manuscript, and she said, "We had different families." You know, and it's true. I mean, when I was born, my mother was 22. When she was born, my mother was 32. When my father came to prominence, I was 22, she was 12. I didn't grow up with a prominent father. I grew up with a father who was making his way. It's a different story. I think that's a very interesting thing. I really tried to keep it. In fact, I was really scrupulous about keeping it my story with him. It's really the story of my relationship with him.
You know, my father wrote about me and mm-hmm. us quite a lot. And so I had the experience, and we were very, very recognizable. And many, many readers of The New Yorker didn't make that distinction, didn't say, oh, this is fiction. And many readers of the short story collections. So it's a very weird experience to pick up a book and read about a ski trip you took or a boyfriend you had mm-hmm. or a fight you had with your father in which you're represented as, you know, not quite as well as you remember yourself and he's represented as much more heroic than you remember him being. Mm-hmm. So perhaps Home Before Dark came out of a desire to revenge myself against the things he'd written about all of us. I mean, I think there's a very interesting moral mm-hmm. question about using other people's lives in your own book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. I think fiction is worse, because in fiction, you're lying. In other words, mm-hmm. my father could write a story, short story about my mother, recognizably my mother, in which through neglect, my brother Fred died. Now, that didn't happen. But that was right. much worse than if he'd been writing a nonfiction essay about my mother and how she was a terrible mother, according to him. So fiction, in a way, to be written about in fiction, I think is more painful than to be written about in nonfiction. But it's a very, very weird feeling. And for me, the great difficulty of writing about family is my children. Mm-hmm. You know, and I have written about my children, but they are innocent. In other words, my father, not an innocent, right? My mother, but my children, I think it's a completely different kind of moral problem. And mm-hmm. I'm just going to stop now.
You know, I think rather than the word vengeance or revenge, I prefer the term, the concept of justice. Mm-hmm. I think you want to do justice to mm-hmm. people and present them the way at least you think they were. With their flaws, with their great qualities, but to correct the public image, which may have been distorted by the media, the press, the public opinion, your own parents' eccentricities, whatever. And again, it's a question of, I come back to the term wholeness, to create a whole, the whole human being as you knew them better than anybody else did. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of, let's use the idea of justice.
Yes, I like that.
Well, there
like
is
that.
The phrase to do justice.
To do justice.
To do justice, the phrase you use means to bring someone alive, yeah. To actually recreate.
Even if you
do right by them, it has many implications.
Even if you write about a really deceitful father like Jeffrey Wolf did in The Duke of Deception, you have to make him whole and do justice to him, as with all his flaws and whatever, and balance out the character.
Well, so that he reveals something
further
about human nature. Well, I mean, that's the point.
The whole point is to, in our own experience, to portray certain people in such a whole way. I mean, that it illuminates a facet of human nature.
Yeah.
It deepens our understanding of human nature.
All three of you have had fathers or a stepfather who were stars, who became stars in their field. I mean, Bishop, the head mm-hmm. of Condé Nast, a great American writer, and you. I mean, how did you see that change your fathers or stepfathers as they became more famous, more powerful? There's some of that in all of your books. I mean, how did that actually... Susan, in your case, your father became... You felt kind of pompous about his celebrity, and then after he went to AA, kind of went back to being a little more humble about it.
Well, it happened
normal.
At the same time. In other words, when he got sober in 1975... That was when his success began as well.
But he had a period in between of fame.
Tiny. In other words, he really, in a certain world, he was well thought of. But the Pulitzer Prize, the bestsellers, the having any money at all, that all came after he got sober. But I think that fame was very disconcerting to him. He didn't know what to make of it. He didn't know if people were going to recognize him on the street. He didn't know if he should like that or not. And he, you know, one of my favorite stories about him is when we put him on the cover of Newsweek, when I was at Newsweek, and I interviewed him. And I said to him, what did you, you know, when you went to your parents and said that you were going to be a writer, what did they say? And he said to me, well, they said, they thought about it overnight, and they said, it's fine with us if you become a writer as long as you don't seek wealth or fame. So I put that in the interview, and everyone in Newsweek thought it was a misprint. In other words, already the whole Yankee idea of what it's okay to strive for had changed so much that everybody thought, oh, this can't be right. But that was how he was brought up. And so when wealth, however tiny it was, and fame came to him, I think it was very disconcerting for him. He had a lot of trouble with it.
And Francine?
Lieberman loved being famous, my God. But I think in his family behavior, he became more distant and removed. Like, I'm thinking of the 80s when he's made, you know, chairman of the whole Condé Nast thing. As compared to what he was in the 50s or 60s, when he was really always thinking of us in any action he took, he became much more selfish and much more removed and ruthless.
And honor.
In my family, his becoming Bishop of New York, which was when he became the most prominent, coincided with the death of my mother and the end of our family as we had known it. So it was actually it was very painful, because not only was he busier, but he had this new wife who was, let's just say, not interested in his children, and but very interested in him. You know?
Yeah, I thought your description of her when she first arrives on the scene was quite brilliant. a little cruel.
And So, but as I said when talking about my siblings, you know, I didn't grow up with a famous father. So
right.
I sort of enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed seeing the fruits of his labors and seeing what he believed in become more public and his having a forum in which to, from which to speak.
It's more implied, I think, than really stated in your book, but do you feel that your mother's death somehow of cancer at age 51 was tied in some psychological way to her discovery of your father's homosexuality? Can you make that kind of connection?
I don't know. I mean, she was very badly injured in an automobile accident in which she was not driving, a kind of freak automobile accident. And then she got, and her liver, she almost died. She had terrible, 7/10 of her liver was removed. They thought she was going to die. The liver regenerated, but it wasn't now. I mean, it wasn't, 18 people telling you should only, drink carrot juice or whatever, Mm-hmm. And she moved with my father to New York.
Hated New York.
Hated New York really because she was exhausted. She hadn't really fully recovered. And I think, of course, that time was more painful than it would have been because of this discovery of mm-hmm. of his sexuality, which she never confronted him about ever and never told any of us about.
But she told friends. She confided
she
in a couple of friends.
She confided in a few friends, but she never betrayed him to us. And I've always thought that that was an extraordinary and very painful bargain that she struck. And then she moved. They separated. She moved back to Washington and almost immediately had colon to liver cancer. And so there was a kind of vulnerability of the liver because of the accident, and it was a very fast cancer. So I think you could say yes and no.
Mm-hmm. May I ask a question?
Sure, yes.
For Karen, you both give very little information on your father's male lovers. Tripp? Is that
Rip.
His name?
Rip.
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 Rip. Rip. I knew it was Rip. And I forget
his real name is Max.
Andrew. And Rex. I would have loved in both. I would love to have known more about each one of them. Now, what is that? A conscious elimination? Is it elicited out of distaste? Your distaste for the theme?
No, it wasn't distaste at all. For one thing, the man that my father was involved with for that long time is now married to a woman who did not want his full identity revealed. But for another, the question I asked my father was, did you love any of them? And what happened to me was that when I had that answer, that was really all I wanted to know. And there still remained great mystery. For my search was not for every single lover that my father had over his lifetime, but it was to understand sort of the terrain of his loves, both women and men, and to kind of feel my response to it. I mean, I felt a tremendous relief when I found out that he had been involved with someone for nearly 30 years, because it was a real relationship, and I was very happy that there was someone with whom he could be whole.
I wrote the book to protect that, so I made it as small and as sweet as I possibly could. Whether or not it was that small or sweet, there's a big biography of my father coming out in March, so we'll all know more. But I wanted to say, one thing you were talking about, how times have changed. This is, one of the great sadnesses for me in contemplating my father's life, that he had this terrible, frightening secret his whole life. Right. And if he had lived later, he wouldn't have had to live that way. Mm-hmm. He lived in fear. Only because he was gay. And, it poisoned a lot of his life. And
you know, now it's completely different. And no. I think that's so wonderful. But I wish that it hadn't, you know, I wish for him that he hadn't had to do that. I remember when Newt Narvin, who was gay and teaching at Smith, was arrested, mm-hmm. and, you know, the terror that went through our household. You know, I remember the terror. I didn't know why. But that his colleagues who were gay had federal agents pounding. I mean, it was a terrifying time to be a gay man. And I'm so grateful that that's not true now, but I'm also sad that he didn't have the benefit of living at a time where it wouldn't have been so awful for him.
But Susan, but I think it's still very difficult for a man, for a married man with children, to be openly gay. I'm sorry, but I think there are a huge amount of married men with children who are still in the closet because of the family. Well, I mean, it's very hard to explain to a 10 or 12 year old, you know, your dad likes men and women.
But that happens often, and certainly my father perhaps never would have been married. In other words, he was gay. And, you know, that he had to, you know, of course I'm glad he married and had children, don't get me wrong.
He was bisexual. Here you are. He loved men and women. You think he really preferred men? I mean, that's something that you don't state. I mean,
The book was written 25 years ago. Yeah. I didn't know very much when I wrote it.
Yeah, and you can see the difference in the time when you're
it was written 6 months after he died.
I think that there's a deeper sadness, which has to do with the complexity of human sexuality and how human sexuality is simply at odds with how society wishes to organize itself. I mean, I think there are people who have bisexual desire, and they want to marry a woman, and they have sexual desire for men, or vice versa. Or there are all kinds of different combinations of sexualities, and it's painful. However, I think Susan's right that the fear is not so great now.
It's better.
As it was.
It's better. It's not
but
perfect.
I think that the complexities are there. I mean, I've talked to people on the road, and, you know, it's complicated.
Well, the reason I asked about your mother and her illness was because what about the woman's role? I mean, how does the woman suffer to discover that her husband's...
Well, it's interesting,
how does that affect the woman? I think that's more, you deal with that, I think, much more than Susan does, again, because it was an earlier time, and your book was so much about your father, and I'm sorry I haven't read the book about your mother and your children, but we'll get to that.
I think it's very complicated. I mean, one of the things you discover when you write a book like this is what's out there, and... I was on one radio program, and this woman called in and says, it's all very well to talk about the pain of the gay person, but what about the straight wife? And then somebody wrote me a letter and told me a story like that, and there turns out to be a whole sort of network of straight spouse, they're called straight spouses, websites and so on, where people can share. And there's legal help and support and therapeutic help and all the things that there are now for every situation, it seems.
But there's been a movie about this now. In other words, it's a very different climate
very
that we're
different.
Living in than it was then.
Far From Heaven, are you talking about Far From Heaven?
No, Brokeback Mountain.
Oh,
which book?
Which one?
I'm talking about Brokeback Mountain.
Well, I was talking
about
The Anger of the Straight Wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is.
That was a very daring movie. That was a courageous movie for that theme. Yeah.
But it did very well. Many people went to see it.
Yeah. Family values went to see it. Sarah Palin.
The Todd Haynes movie Far From Heaven, which is actually set in the 50s, mm-hmm. is and early 60s,
right.
is very powerful. I myself wept from the first frame to the end.
Yeah, I think Brokeback Mountain was also very, 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 very touching.
Yeah.
But I think it's time maybe to open this up to the audience if any of you have questions.
I just wondered for your material, if your subjects had left any memoirs of their own, how much you used letters, diaries, and things like that, because you couldn't possibly remember all these things. I mean, I'm working on my father's memoirs, and I wish he was still here so I could ask him all these things. Now the questions come up.
We wrote letters in our family, and my parents wrote 2,000 pages of letters to each other when they were courting during the war and the first year of their marriage. And I thought before, my father did write a memoir, but he left this part of his life out of it. And so I had that as a source, and I had an oral history at Columbia, and I had his other two books, and my mother's book, and, you know, my own diaries, and...
Well, that was a question I wanted to ask all three of you. Yeah. You've all always kept journals, I gather?
I've kept a journal since my last year of college, and it comes to about 81 physical volumes, which I think
every, do you really write every day?
No, I don't write everywhere. I catch up. I used to when I was younger and had more to cry about. Now I sort of catch up by the week, almost by a week or by 2 week slots. It's, I mean, the pace of it has changed a deal. Mm. But I still do, and I still have a compulsion to write down dreams. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from, you know,
It was a dream that sort of in a dream that you felt you were being told to
write the book. Yeah, I mean, dreams are very important to me, and I had a very classical, short but very classical, totally classical Freudian analysis. I mean, the little that I had was completely classical, you know, with the lying on the couch with the shrink behind me and so on. And I think from that time when I had to remember dreams, because they're pivotal to that kind of therapy, I've always kept a journal.
An honor?
I keep journals periodically. If I'm writing something, I tend not to keep a journal. I have spurts. I do have journals, though, starting from my early 20s and some before that, and letters. So there's a lot of...
Letters, it's becoming a lost art, and yeah, it's unfortunate for biographers.
And to answer this lady's question, my stepfather and my mother left a huge amount of love letters from... The pre-war days when they were lovers and my mother was still married my father. Now, I remember the interesting thing that I was home alone in our little flat in Central Park South the first year we arrived, and I just learned that my father had died. And I was just looking for some notepaper to write my own letters to. And I came across this cache of letters exchanged between my mother and my stepfather, who is not yet my stepfather, who's just a lover. And I started reading them, and I don't think I've ever cried more fervently than I did that time. I was dissolved by the idea that my mother had been in love with this man while my father was still alive. Mm-hmm. And I thought I had this sort of utopia that, no, they fell in love after my father had died. And it was a violent, violent reaction. And then... years later, after my stepfather died, I wanted to see the letters again, and I just, went into his room, and they were right on the drawer of his bedside table, which is, he was already remarried, and that kind of touched me that he would want to keep the letters of my mother in his bedside table.
Yes, I remember that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the only material I had, that and my own journals, which... Mm.
And Susan, I had a few letters. No, I don't keep a journal. Mm. I mean, again, sporadic. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I will, sometimes I won't. Mostly I don't.
Bad girl.
I know, and I don't write every day, and I don't get up in the morning and have a writing ritual, and I don't do any of those things. But my father kept copious journals, and in fact, that's how I found out he was gay, was that I had started, when he was sick, writing down his stories, because I didn't want us to lose all these great stories he told. And I was supposed to be writing something else, and every morning I'd get up and think, you should write your novel, but instead I'd write down more of his stories. And he was always talking about these journals, yakety-yak-yak. And he had this idea
that the day he died, the IRS would swoop down on the house, value the journals at $10 million, and tax us to oblivion, right? So when he died, I had taken the journals in a
this
box.
This is what writers really think about.
Right, and put them in Morgan Manhattan, the old Morgan Manhattan. And so I thought, when I was writing these stories, I thought, well, I'll say something about these journals. So I went to Morgan Manhattan, I opened the vault, I opened a box, I opened a journal, and bingo. That was when I found out he was gay, unquestionably gay. And that was, I mean, the journals are just extremely graphic. So that was actually not just a resource, but it changed the whole course of the book.
Just because of these connections. My father, I have an image in my book of my father reading your father's journals. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying, well, I don't think I'm going to be as candid as Mr. Cheever. And then looking back, you know, it was like a kid reading an adventure story. Mm. Mm.
But were these published?
Yes.
They were.
It's a million words. And so Bob Gottlieb actually took on the job of editing it down to one volume, yeah. Which is how it was published.
Sort of like the Warhol Diaries, which actually started out as a record for the IRS.
Right, exactly. I hope someday the whole journal will be published, because it's, you know, it's a lot funnier than the published one.
Yes?
Writing about my children puts writing about my parents in the shade, no question. I mean, writing about my parents, they're both writers. My children, of course, I swore that I would never do what my parents did, as we all do. And then what happened was Newsday offered me a parenting column. So I went to my children, who were then 14 and 7, and asked their permission. And they said, okay. But of course, I knew they didn't know what they were agreeing to. So then we set up a system where whenever I wrote a column, I would read it to them, and they could edit it. And whenever I wrote about them, I could read it to them, and they could edit it. And sometimes we had terrible fights. Because I would want to use something and they wouldn't want me to. And so sometimes I would pay them. And sometimes they wanted a percentage. And sometimes they wanted a flat rate. And sometimes there was no amount of money that would make it all right, and then I didn't use it. But we had some very heated negotiations about certain things. I mean, my son had an irrational fear, and it cost me a lot of money to put that. And then I ended up writing a book out of my columns, and again we went through this process. But to some extent, although I've always asked their permission, and with desire, my daughter was in the opening scene, which is my third wedding, and I took her out at her request, and then I put her back in at her request. And my son is only in one scene, which is okay with him. However, it's really ingenuous of me, because in a way, they're agreeing to something that they don't understand, even now when they are 26 and 18. And let me say that my daughter was profoundly upset by the story in the New York Times, which appeared last week, 2 weeks ago, which I didn't write it. I'm innocent. But, you know, my children have very mixed feelings about this whole thing, and they have different names than I do, which I hope protects them a little bit so that they have a little bit of choice about whether or not to let this out, but I think it's very hard for them. But just to tell one nice story, 10 years ago I wrote a book about my drinking, which also kind of detailed what I did wrong in my second marriage. And my daughter had always thought that I was perfect and that her father was a villain. And she had never understood why he was angry at me. And when she read this book, she understood very well why he was angry at me. And I think that helped. This is my fantasy. But soon after that, she was really able to reconcile with him in a way she hadn't before. So I do think that the truth has a value of its own. But you know, only last week my daughter was saying to me about the New York Times, how could you? So it isn't easy ever.
I think children vary too. I mean, I have one son who doesn't give a darn about what I write, and then I have another one who made me promise that I'd never write about the family again.
Hmm.
And it's totally.
Did you promise?
The what?
Did you promise?
Well, I sort of. I sort of said I'll think about it, but you know, what is interesting to me is the wish. I think they really are embarrassed being thrust into the public eye.
Yeah.
That they would rather do it themselves in their own way. And I think, and I can understand that. I can understand that.
I can too.
My parents never thrust me into the public eye in that way. And so I was able to really handle my own level of exposure to the public, mm-hmm. and control it completely. And that is what they're not getting, is complete control, mm-hmm. over their exposure to the public. And I think that's what I think we've got to be very careful and keep that degree of their control sacrosanct.
Mm-hmm. I think we have time for one more.
Okay. Yes.
If you were to write your book as fiction, so as not to disturb any of the living family, would you get the same satisfaction out of it? Would it have the same feeling for
That's
you?
That's a good, very good question.
If you were
is this
to
a question?
Fictionalize your family story.
Well, I think all three could address that.
Well,
if you were to write your books as fiction, would you get the same kind of satisfaction out of writing?
I think
books.
That fiction and nonfiction are very, very different. I have written this as fiction, as it happens. But I don't think fiction protects the people you're writing about, because my experience in being written about in fiction is that it was the opposite of protective, that I had, you know, my father, when I was 12 years old, to tell an ugly little story, I picked up a book of my father's short stories, and I read this interesting account of a ski trip we had all gone on, in which I was called Annie, but it was me. It had my asthma attack. It did all the things I did. It skied the way I skied. And at the end of the story, the little girl, me, is crushed in the ski tow and killed. And so as a 12-year-old, you know, reading along, I wish he had had to write nonfiction. In other words, in my experience, it's much harder on the family to be fictionalized. But I found very different satisfactions in writing this material fictionally than I did in nonfiction. And let me just say, nonfiction is a brand new genre. It's completely changed in the last 20 years. And we're just beginning with nonfiction. We're just beginning with memoir and biography. And you can do all kinds of things that no one's ever done before. It's so exciting to me as a writer. I'm writing a biography now, and I'm actually able to do things that biographers haven't done before. So in a way, to me, nonfiction has this appeal of being new and not explored and not by better people than myself and not completely. But I don't think that fiction protects. I often have students who, when they get to the hard part, you know, when they get to the part where their 18-year-old brother seduced them when they were 12, they say to me, you know, I'm going to switch to fiction. And I say to them, good luck, but it won't protect anybody. It won't make him any less angry.
Would you like to comment
on that? You have to answer.
Yeah. I thought that was a great answer.
No, I think people are more hurt by finding themselves in fiction than in nonfiction, in some curious way. I don't know why. I think that they hate to be used, to be manipulated that way, whereas if you write about them in nonfiction, they don't feel manipulated, as if they are taken out of life and put into something which is supposed to be art. You know, mm-hmm. they don't like it. They would like to control. Again, it's a question of control.
Well, because in fiction, you are allowed to lie or
imagine.
Right,
that's
or,
right, that's
or
right.
Change
they feel more,
the facts.
Their control, that sense of control, is diminished in the fiction.
On that note, we will. Oh, is there one more question? All right, one more quick question. Did you want to ask a question?
When I discovered what?
When your father really wasn't, your mother was sleeping with your father.
She was 12.
Those letters.
The letters. I was 11.
Too young.
Thank you all for coming.